Good evening. Thank you for joining us for another week of Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Region. I'm your host for the first half tonight, Diamond. Socially disengaged, a lack of capability, and shackled to our phones. This is what many picture as the average youth. But what goes against society's general perception of this age group being, for the most part, healthy, begins to shatter as the rising demand of mental health services for Toronto's youth continues. According to statistics gathered by CAMH, Center for Addiction and Mental Health, 70% of mental health problems have their onset during childhood or adolescence. Additionally, young people aged 15 to 24 are more likely to experience mental illness or substance abuse than any other age group. With growing demands and concerns, many universities and businesses are doing more to combat the lack of services for Toronto's youth. Today, I'm joined with some guests to help discuss our thoughts on youth and mental health. Welcome.
Hello.
So, what perceptions do you think today's society has of youth that affects how they look upon youth affected by mental health?
I don't know. I think sometimes they could see it as people acting out or give them undue responsibility when it comes to mental health. Like, sometimes they have to be absolved of responsibility.
Yeah.
What do you think, Joel? No? No comment?
No, I had no problem. I'm sorry.
That's well, right. Being at the pinnacle of youth, some would say, I feel like just the general perceptions of us not really caring about like what society thinks of us and feel like we're just lashing out and seeking attention.
Right.
Yeah. So like,
or the hormones, you know,
yeah,
you're a teenager.
I get that so much time. Oh, she's just acting like this because she's just like, you know, a young female still going through that,
right,
and all that stuff. Oh, she's being dramatic because of this.
Or
right?
Her body's just like going crazy. So
yeah.
She's crazy. Whatever.
There's a lot of things like that. Or she's like, oh, maybe she's just stressed from these certain things. But like, sometimes
I think there needs to be a careful balance with that, because I understand that sometimes when you jump to conclusions, you could really emotionally scar a child or just, you know, really scare them for no reason, because maybe there's no real issue. But at the same time, when you underestimate what they're going through, you're just saying, oh, you can get out of this. Don't worry. What you're really doing is that you are letting something fester and grow and potentially become more dangerous if you don't actually face it.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah. So what are your experience with mental health within a school setting?
Within a school setting?
Yes.
Well, I was diagnosed with a learning disability. I had to take prescriptions for it. It was really... So I was diagnosed with ADHD in school, and when it came to university, it was so demanding, and it wasn't just any university, it was the University of Toronto, and it's just so competitive and so difficult, and so I was diagnosed with ADHD, and then I had to do, it wasn't as difficult as I thought it would be. Actually, they were really accommodating, but the thing is, when someone has a learning disability, you should not give them a bunch of paperwork to fill out, because it's a lot of work, right?
Yeah,
definitely.
And, you know, like, then you have to get them to sign papers and get the doctor's documents, and you're already forgetful as it is. So it was very challenging in that way. And then I guess it was a difficult period, but at the same time was really eye-opening for me, because I had to take these medications to pay attention. But the thing is, with everyone has different experiences with medication. I had to try a different a couple for ADHD. They were not always so fun. I found the one that was a better fit for me, but at the same time, like, the least side effects, but still had side effects.
Yeah.
Either way. And I did not enjoy it. So I had to really ask myself, is this, because ADHD is like something that's diagnosed for a lifetime. It's not like, you know, just like it's just a phase or it's just a couple years. It's asked, it's a diagnosis for a lifetime, and then if I'm taking prescription drugs for it, then I have to be in drugs for the rest of my life. So I really had to ask myself, do I want to do this? Like, do I want to be on drugs forever? And then I found out that it's a stimulant, and because it's a stimulant, it could really alter your brain, your brain genetics and everything. And you can become dependent on it, and it was no different than methamphetamine to some degree, maybe just a lower grade, but that's pretty much what it was. And I had no appetite, and I was constantly studying, and I had no passion. Like, when I was on medication, I had, like, zero passion or anything, so I really didn't like how I felt or who I was on it. Even though there was pretty good accommodations, like they gave me some kind of grant in school for having a disability because my brain don't work. And so so they gave me a grant for that. They also, there wasn't a lot of, I asked for like extra time and stuff. It was so hard to do that. Like, you have to get your doctor's like letter and stuff to say that you have this, and every time you go to your doctor, because you're not going to a family doctor, you're going to your psychiatrist. And you need to, like, pay these fees to meet your psychiatrist. And then you have to pay, like, money to
get for the doctor's
one doctor's note, right?
By the time you do all that, you'll be broke.
I know, right? And I was just like, I don't want to do this, right? And I was like, so I didn't get a lot of extra time, which I think would have helped so much for me. So I was forced to, like, study more and just be more stringent on taking my drugs in order to study, right? And it was, like, a really bad, toxic cycle. But then, so that was very scarring. And I eventually graduated University of Toronto. Not to say it was the university. I don't want to get sued here. But not to say it was the University of Toronto, per se. But it was just, like, there's just so many procedures when it comes to institutions, right? But after that, after my emotional scarring, I left school. But then I wanted to do a program in journalism. So I found the perfect one at a college, Humber College. But I was just, like, freaked out by the idea of going back to school and having to take drugs again. I was vehemently not going to take any more drugs. And by this time, I already, like, learned different coping mechanisms. I was told that meditation really helps for concentration. So I practiced meditation for a long time. And so when I went to Humber College, I just told them I was diagnosed with ADHD. They didn't require, like,
all that paperwork.
All that paperwork. They just took my word for it. It's like, oh, okay, you have brain problems, whatever. You get extra time. They gave me extra time for tests and stuff. And they gave me a lot of notifications. Like, this is the time you have to sign up for an extra, to book the space to do extra time and to do your tests and stuff like that. Like, they're very accommodating. So I think when it comes to the education system, it's really about the institution. Like, how maxed out are they when it comes to their resources? I think U of T was very maxed out with their resources. They have so many students, so many departments, so many people they have to deal with. So, like, in that way, they don't have the capacity to be accommodating. At a Humber, like, I didn't have to go through all the hoops to jump through and stuff and deal with stuff. And I had a lot of accommodations, but then, you know, I also realized I didn't need them too at that point in my life, because I think I just learned how to develop or learn different practices. And also it was college, so it was much, much more relaxed than university. So that was my experience.
Like you were saying, like, you have to get all this paperwork and it's so much money. Just, it requires so much money.
You know,
just
it's
to...
just like those little, like, sometimes when your mind is, like, not always good at details, like, you lose one piece of paperwork and it's, like, it's essential, but you just lose it and you're like, damn it, right?
You lose focus, don't you?
Yeah, I lose focus. But, you know, also, I think it was also a contributing factor was not only was university super hard, but I don't think it was my passion. I think that's why I had a lot of ADHD then. Like, so...
Let me ask you a question, Judy. I'm sorry to interrupt. But what about your peers? In school or whatever, did they treat you any different?
Nobody knew. I didn't like to tell people. I did tell a couple people, but for the most part, I didn't tell anyone. There was one person I taught because she told me that she had ADHD, and I was like, me too. I got brain problems too, girl.
So it's kind of like a bonding, right? So,
right, like okay. Your disability bonding.
That's true. Okay.
So do you think institutions and businesses are doing enough to combat these stereotypes labeled?
Institutions and businesses?
Yeah. So like institutions, like as you were saying, like university institutions or things like that.
I don't think institutions do. I think the people do.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who have the problems, the disabilities or the stigma, they're the ones who advocate the most. And you see them as the face.
Mm-hmm.
I was just watching a TED Talk on this woman who was a comedian. I forgot her name. But she has cerebral palsy.
Mm-hmm.
She was hilarious. But I see her as the person who changes the image around cerebral palsy more than any institution does.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see people like Stephen Hawking, who I forgot what his problem was, but he's in a wheelchair. And he's like degenerative mm-hmm. a brain. I don't know what the specific name for it is, but he is one of the greatest minds in our era.
Mm-hmm.
But he's clearly has a disability. And when you see a man like that, it's kind of inspiring, right?
Yeah.
But it's not because he's actually advocating so much, but it's because he is who he is.
Yeah.
And he's okay with it, right? And inspires
his name
people.
Gets him a lot of backing, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
The guy who invented, like, Microsoft or something like, you know, big...
Oh, that's Bill Gates.
Oh, sorry, my bad.
Stephen Hawking, he is our Einstein. This era's Einstein. So he's a physicist, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
And his focus is the cosmology, so the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's all I really know about him.
I know a lot of universities, what I'm being told by like my friends, have like certain like wellness centers, I guess, where they bring in like animals, like dogs, where you can like pet when you're like stressed and things like that.
At Humber College, they did have one of those. They're called like therapy dogs or something. So it's just a dog.
Yeah.
But I think, so I asked the woman who is the dog's owner, I asked her, I was like, what kind of certification did she have to have in order to...
There's like no certain
none.
Like, yeah,
he just has
like,
to be like a cool dog.
Yeah, like it's funny because like you know when you like sign up for those like job like things like Indeed,
right.
I got one the other day and I was saying how like oh there's one for being a wellness trainer or whatever
right.
where like you can walk around dogs and all that stuff. I was like cool, I want to do that.
Yeah.
But it's like oh you bring your own dog
right
and you just bring it to certain places like hospitals or things like that where you can make like kids feel better. And I was just like so there's no like certification for that like how to
yeah,
have animals
like or... I thought it was the same thing as like the blind dogs
yeah.
right? The dogs that like you know lead the blind, nothing like that. So I asked her, I was like what did you have to do? She's like I just had to go to the center. And they just gauged his temperament.
Yeah.
So if he's like a cool dog,
mm-hmm.
if he doesn't bite people when he gets petted, that's fine. That's like A-okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was just it. But I think it was a good vibe to have him around. Like animals or people loved him. I guess animals do too. But who knows? So and we always knew when he was around, and there was always a bunch of people around him.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do as individuals to combat these stereotypes? You know, we see institutions and businesses and commercials trying to, like, combat them. What can we do within our communities?
I guess we could talk about it and normalize it. Yeah, because, you know, I know I have a diagnosis for ADHD, but I haven't really followed up on it since the horror years of my university. That's probably giving me some PTSD, too. So I've got a lot of that, too. But I don't actually talk about it because I don't see it as, like, a huge facet of my life. So I think, in a way, that's a little healthy, right? Because I think sometimes people, they, not to their own fault, but also to the people around them, they usually centralize their disability.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes their identity.
Yeah.
Like, oh, like... oh, he's autistic. No, he has autism, mm-hmm. you know? Like, he's not that thing. He just happens to have it, right?
I know a lot of people in, like, companies, even, like, within, like, workshops in school are trying to change the language towards people who deal with mental health challenges. So I like the way you're saying, like, he's not autistic. He has autism. Like, mm-hmm. yeah. And what you were saying before, like, I never thought of, like, I don't know why I never thought of it, like, how you said, like, ADHD is, like, a lifelong thing.
Right.
Not, like, in the moment. And it's not that, like, I never really thought that it would be just a phase in someone's life. But, like, it never dawned on me, like, mm-hmm. if you understand.
Right.
And how you were saying before how, yeah, we should talk more about it. Like, do you think people coming up and owning their disability and saying, instead of hiding it, like, and not saying anything about them having a disability, do you think that would be better or worse?
I don't know. I think you have to play your cards right. Like, I don't talk about my ADHD. I really don't. The only reason why I talked about it is because you asked, and I was just like, okay, well, we need to have a conversation.
Yeah.
Can't have dead air, right?
Yeah.
So, but for the most part, I don't really talk about it, and not because, like, I have any shame around or anything, but I really don't think it's any, like, it has no effect to my life right now. Mm-hmm. I'm in a good place, and I'm pretty on top of my stuff. I should probably use an agenda more, you know, to remember things. But for the most part, I think everything is pretty handled well in my life. Mm-hmm. But when it comes, you know, it's not so much that you should talk about it, but you should have a safe space you could talk about
it.
If you choose to talk about it. Because sometimes mm-hmm. you just don't want to. Sometimes it's not part of the conversation. Sometimes it's not the right place, you know, whatever. But if you want to, you should be able to have a space where people are okay to hear it. And they're not going to, like
judge you at all.
Really. Exactly. Like, think weird of you. Like, what's wrong with you? Or, like, oh, I can't talk to her anymore. Like, she's not going to pay attention because she has ADHD.
I know a lot of guys who used to have ADHD. I know a couple guys, but they won't talk about it in public. Why? Because the public will judge us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Society will judge us on who we are and what we do.
Mm-hmm.
You see a normal person outside in the streets, like, oh, you're like a freak, or you're like like some kind of weird person or crazy person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People laugh at things they don't understand.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I've seen it a lot. Same thing. I seen it in my community. I live in the West End. Like the Jane area, right? And there's a lot of people with learning disabilities, but you have to know who to talk to, especially in the Black community. The Black community doesn't go to psychiatrists.
No. It's like a huge culture where it's like mental illness is not a thing.
Exactly.
It's not even like because they don't want to. I feel like pride's in the way of
exactly,
that.
Right.
And not even the way we're grown. It's just we don't really, like, you know, go there. Like, why talk about your troubles or your negativities? Well, what they think and believe is negativities, and go out. Like, you don't want to show your flaws to society, right?
Exactly.
That's what it is. That's what I think it is.
We have, like, your mom or Jesus.
Yes.
That's what it is. You know it's true.
Yeah.
Come on. It's either, especially in the Jamaican culture, you either have, like, your pastor or your grandmother or the home.
Yeah.
They keep it in a very tight society because they don't want society to judge them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to judge the urban community.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm just saying that just on my standpoint, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I see things different. I totally agree with what you're saying, Judy. No problem, but I just see it from an urban perspective,
yeah.
I guess.
But I also had to learn. I think it was a good thing for me to share it sometimes with people. When people judge me, I'll be like, screw you. You're not my friend anymore, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't care about you. I could find a bunch of friends. So I think I had to learn. Because when I was having so much trouble in school, I was constantly feeling like, I can't do this. There's something wrong with me. And then I would never tell anyone. And I had these prescriptions. And someone found them one day. Like, my prescription. Like, because, you know, I have to carry them around. Mm-hmm. My drugs, right? My bottle of drugs. And then someone, like, I don't know, snooping into my bag, right? Like, who are you? You're not even my friend anymore. If you're listening. but they found my drugs. And they're like, what is this? And then I think they looked it up, right? Because, like, you know, like, because I think sometimes people are just like, drugs, like, what's wrong with her kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So they looked it up and they found out what I had. And they're like, why didn't you tell me? And I was like, because it's like, you know, a thing that people judge you on, right? And it's like, and at the same time, now I realize I was like, I was very, like, very much mortified to have to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was, like, I was caught cheating on someone, you know? That's how I felt, right? Like, I should have been honest, right? Yeah. I should have told him that I take drugs, right? But
the way you put it.
But then it's like, it's none of your business, you know? True. It's really none. Like, if I choose to make it your business by telling you, then sure. But it's really none of your business, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's why a lot of people don't want to talk about it, because they feel like if they do or they get exposed or something, like, yeah. people are going to, like, make a big deal. Because it really...
feel sorry for you. And, you know,
yeah,
I mean?
Or just, like, anything. It's just, like, it, make a big deal of it. Right. It's, like, don't... First yeah. of all, why are you in my bag, right? Where's my money? Yeah. You know? But, yeah. So, like, I think sometimes that's why people keep it to themselves. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes we're afraid. We don't know how people are going to take it. And mm-hmm. we anticipate the worst. But now yeah. I've gotten to a point where, like, even the worst doesn't worry me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm okay, you know. I'm okay yeah. with myself, that I know that whether or not you're okay with it, I'm okay with it.
Mm-hmm. See, that's why we need that safe space like we were talking about before. So suicide is the second leading cause of death in this age group, second to accidental deaths, as well as 4,000 Canadians die of suicide, estimated by the Canadian Mental Health Association. Have teachers discussed the matter of suicide effectively when you're at school, or would you like to see, what would you like to see when it comes to schools, the school's response to this issue regarding suicide?
I think sometimes they treat it as like an emergency, like mm-hmm. don't do it, like don't take your life. It's like, but you have to understand why they get to a point where they want to commit mm-hmm. suicide, right? That I think it's not so much about like admonishing them, but really understanding, having that empathy for those people, because those people who are going through a difficult, painful experience or phase in their life,
mm-hmm.
The last thing they need is people to push them, even if you're trying to do the best for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a time for tough love, you know?
Yeah.
So I think with schools, they have to really have workers who have that kind of emotional intelligence yeah. when it comes to these things.
Like, my experience in school, like, I felt like it's a touch, obviously it's a touchy subject, but I feel like teachers are afraid to talk about it.
That's true.
Like,
that's very,
you know,
true.
How, like, when you're in, like, elementary school and you guys start talking about, like, sexual health, mm-hmm. it's that type of, like, you know, they don't want to talk about it. They don't, not that they don't feel like it's important, but they don't know how to go about talking about it. Mm-hmm. And to the point where they just read it off of a paper. Like, there's no intimate, like, you know, there's that, not even personal experience, but there's, like, no, like, originality to me. Like,
there's no that one-on-one.
Yeah, like, yeah. when I, they just feel so automatic. Like, it, they just feel like they're like, a dialogue that's exactly. already been written
or
by
like,
them.
It's like, it's clinical. Yeah. Like, oh, you have this kind of morbid suicide ideation, yeah. you know? They call it, like, those technical words, right? And if you're suicidal, you're just like, what the F is going on? I'm going to cut myself now, you know? Like, yeah. it's just like, this doesn't help, like, whatever yeah. you're doing. Like, you need to get in touch with yourself so mm-hmm. you can get in touch with me, right?
Yeah, and because they use, like, things that they, like, they give you on paper that's already on somewhere, like, they just read it right. off of somewhere. I feel like, just only talking for myself, I'm pretty sure a lot of people feel like this. Like, if I was in a situation, if my friend or a loved one would say, like, I feel suicidal, I don't even know what to do.
Yeah.
Like, I was reading, right. like, a magazine where they were saying, like, it was like a quiz, like, what would you do? Like, how would you go? But, yeah, yeah, I have a lot of free time.
I would be the worst person to go to. I feel like once I was bummed out, too.
Yeah, like.
It's not the same. It's, like, this deep, dark place they're in, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the worst things you could do, I feel like, is say, oh, they're healthcare professionals. Because you're implying that they need a professional. Like, yeah. there's something messed up with them. And you're saying that they're in a space that they gave you their mm-hmm. confidence,
yeah.
and you're not accepting it, or you're not, you know, embracing it. Then it's almost saying, like, yet another person is letting mm-hmm. me down, you know?
That's funny, because, like, when I was reading, they said that it was, like, you can't keep it. Like, you have to tell, like, someone, whether it be, like, their parents or, like,
yeah,
your
you
doctors.
Yeah, you can definitely,
like,
tell
yeah.
other people, but you have to also say, like, I'm here to listen, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you can't really hold all that with yourself, but yeah, you definitely do have to like be there for them.
So thank you for our guests for staying with us for this part of the show. Sadly, we're all out of time for this first half, so please stay tuned after this musical break.
Hamaru mi taku huma si yame ale dine ne kungali o bulunu hamayo de mandi do taku yuma uluga yudi taku tsaku bena dalumi ehigaminga uma bunga hamaru de mandi do ha
Welcome back to Catch the Flavor, Youth Radio at RadioRegion.com. I'm your host, Big Daddy J, also known as Joel Williams. All right, as many of us know, Toronto is a very diverse and Toronto is a very diverse and housing hundreds of different cultures in our communities. One of the growing communities in the urban population, like Toronto, in our Indigenous youth. That's why our team of Indigenous youth got together to create a National Urban Youth Council of Toronto. They hope to connect and grow the number of youth in Toronto and provide them with a safe place to learn and grow. They also especially are doing to help this address and align to societies in Toronto. Now, we have a clip of one of their stories and projects.
I wake up with an aching head and a numb body. I slept for 13 hours last night. My phone says it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I missed 4 calls. My stomach's empty, but I have no desire to eat. I find comfort in the feeling of being drained. My blanket guards me like a prison warden. I ignore my texts in the same manner as I do the rest of the world. I want nothing more than to lie here passively and allow this subtle pain to devour me. The color of my skin is not what it's supposed to be. My name betrays my face, and the words that I speak don't belong to me. My shame is the only thing that's acceptable. They tell me who I am and who I can't be. They've taken everything, and they won't stop until there's nothing left. I fought against these voices for a long time, trying to fill the void with shallow novelties. My strength has been exhausted, my resolve has been extinguished, and the only choice that remains is to expend the little bit of strength I have left and relinquish. My heart strikes me with every beat like I'm a worn-out drum. Boom, 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 boom. Cracks in the ice. Boom, 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 boom. Silent screams. Boom, 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 boom. And I'm drowning. Then I realize that I'm wrong. The rhythm of my heart isn't trying to beat me down. Spurring me forward, driving me, pushing me in the direction that I need to go. I'm alive. I can feel the blood flowing through me. I focus on my breathing. And I reflect on things in this life that I can't choose. There are things that are beyond my control, but I alone choose how they affect me. That's my responsibility. Now I can see I'm not the only one. We're all hurting. We all suffer. We may have different wounds, but the feeling of pain is the same. I want to heal. I want to help others heal. I can see the monsters inside now, stabbing us with fear, protecting themselves without regret. I will fight back with hope. I will protect myself with joy. There's a home I can see on the horizon, where we live together as a family. It's not there yet, but I know it's warm, and I know it's safe. And I know that if I pick up a tool to build it, I can rely on your hands to help me.
That was an audio from the Fifth Region, a storytelling project from the Toronto Indigenous Youth Council. If you're just tuning in right now at Catch the Flavor, the youth show on RadioRegion.com, I'm your host, Joel Williams. Today, we have Joshua Strabel, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, with the president and CEO of the National Urban Youth Council of Toronto. This organization seeking an identity address and support the needs of Indigenous living outside of the Indigenous homes regions and outside of the Arctic regions. Born and raised in Keswick, Ontario, with the families, and originally from
Iqaluit. Iqaluit Nunavut.
I'm sorry, my
fault. No, it's okay. It's just president. There's no like CEO. Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry,
it's
my
okay.
fault.
It's okay.
Joshua serves a program worker for the Toronto Indigenous Youth of Toronto. Joshua, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the program, sir. And thank you for joining us on this opportunity for talking with us about the National Urban Youth in Toronto. Okay. In your own words, what is the National Urban Youth Youth Council about?
So it's the National Urban Inuit Youth Council. Mm-hmm. And so we are a 6-person council, and we've established to begin identifying, addressing, and supporting the needs of Inuit who live outside of the 4 regions. There's 4 Inuit regions in the Arctic from east to west. It's Inuvialuit above Northwest Territories, Nunavut, which everyone probably knows is the hardest one to color on the map mm-hmm. when you're in school. Nunavik, which is northern Quebec, and then Nunatsiavut, which is above Labrador. Mm-hmm. Okay. But our people are moving to southern communities at a very rapid rate. Between 2006 and 2011, in Toronto alone, the amount of people who identified as Inuit within Toronto rose from just over 300 to about 680. The rate of growth was 108%.
Wow.
So if you apply the same rate of growth to today, which is a very fair estimation that we can make, we're looking at over 1,500 that live in Toronto alone.
Wow.
And when we actually look at those statistics, we are the youngest population in Canada. In 2006, when you're looking at just Arctic communities, our median age was 23.
Wow.
When the rest of the country is like 42.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay. When was it established, and where is it located?
So it was established a few months ago, actually, in June. So I also run a youth program in Toronto.
Right.
For Inuit youth in Toronto called Toronto Mitayugut, which means we are from Toronto Indian Institute. Mm-hmm. We had co-hosted an Indigenous youth leadership forum with Taking It Global. And so it was sort of an opportunity for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit youth to come together from across the country. And we hosted it in King City. And it was something that we had spoken about, myself and Mika, who is our vice president. Her and I had spoken at length about sort of having an urban organization to begin representing youth that live outside of the four regions. Mm-hmm. And it was at that leadership forum that we kind of sat down and said, you know what, we need to start this. And so in June, we formally announced that we are established. And so now we're in the process of incorporation. And we're going to be launching sort of a conference to kind of introduce people to what we're doing in early next year, so January or February. At this point, I guess we're kind of located in Toronto because we have a dedicated youth program here in Toronto, and I myself am a full-time employee for the Toronto community.
Okay.
And so part of our mandate as the Toronto community is to help build the capacity mm-hmm. of this National Urban Inuit Youth Council. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to dedicate some of my time to building this council.
Wow, okay. Why is it such important to curate an organization for Inuit youth, especially over an for another of ranges of ages?
It's really important to establish this council. So in Toronto, there were no services for Inuit up until 2 years ago. There are services for First Nations. I believe there are services for Métis. And there's a lot that were sort of pan-Indigenous, so just like trying to blanket Indigenous people as if they're all one, but none specifically dedicated to providing services for our people. And that's not to say that we weren't here. I mean, I've lived in the Toronto area my entire life. An elder in our community named Alex, she's lived in Toronto for the same amount of time that I've been alive, you know, 26 years. And so it was important for us to, especially at the rapid rate that we're moving to southern communities, it's really important to start having organizations that are dedicated to providing services for our community members. And it's also very important that these organizations be run by our people, to be run, you know, so Inuit-led, youth-led. Directed towards identifying, addressing, and supporting the needs of our youth who are here in the South. Mm-hmm. And it's important to be able to do that because, I mean, if you look at the resources that the four regions have for themselves, it's very difficult for them to even provide adequate support to their communities. And so they can't be expected to, you know, support all of our community members who are outside of the Arctic. Mm-hmm. There's also different funding opportunities that we have access to that they don't. Mm-hmm. For instance, our grant here in Toronto is a provincial grant. Mm-hmm. You know, none of the four regions are going to get access to provincial funding. But if it's an organization that's dedicated to a demographic that lives within Ontario, then, of course, you can apply and receive that funding. And so at this point, Ontario seems to be, you know, we have the most infrastructure for our people here. We want to be able to now, through this national council, identify and locate our youth who want to be leaders in other cities, in other communities across Canada, and help them mobilize and begin accessing those resources.
Okay.
So we can begin, you know, really healing the effects of colonization that have impacted our communities.
Okay. When it comes to mental health and wellness, how does your organization curate a specific for the population executives?
So in terms of like mental health and wellness, we actually just started this this initiative called Tundra Squad. Okay. So like hashtag Tundra Squad if you guys are listening to that, you know. So basically it's an idea for Inuit to promote health and wellness. So we did our first event a few weeks ago. It was kayaking on the lakeshore here in Toronto. But we're really trying to encourage any Inuit to use that hashtag Tundra Squad to kind of show what do you do to be healthy and active. And so even with a lot of just our community events, we tend to try and buy healthier food options. So we don't tend to buy pop and stuff for our events because we want to promote, you know, good dietary lifestyles. And so on one hand, too, we want to start producing these videos that are sort of just, you know, you kind of go to the grocery store, you buy all these items. Mm-hmm. What can you make with all of these items? And so not just have like one meal that you make, but like maybe a breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yeah. And say you buy, you know, rice, and we buy that, and we show that we bought this, and we create more videos. You know, you kind of show if you're making another rice meal in another video, we're still using that same box. Okay. So just show the longevity of. And so, you know, healthy active living isn't just about, you know, exercise, isn't just about eating well. Mental health isn't just about those things too. It's also about personal responsibility in terms of just taking responsibility for your actions, but also fiscal responsibility, being a prudent person. So really, you know, everything in life is kind of connected, right? Okay. And so really, Tundra Squad is about trying to equip our youth with the tools that they need to have healthy active lifestyles and then encourage them to do that and then support them and give them opportunities to do that.
Okay. What is the current state of the mental health and wellness of the Inuit population?
So that's a really challenging question. We have the highest suicide rate in the country. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is taking information from 2006. It's hard to gather a lot of information in Arctic communities, census data. So it isn't compiled as regularly as, you know, every 5 years here in the rest of the country. But when we look at 2006, the suicide rate in the north, so for Inuit, it was, I believe, 112 citizens per 100,000 that committed suicide. And at the time, in Canada, it was 11 per 100,000. And so you have, you know, literally 100 more, 100 times more people committing suicide. Now, when we look at the median age being 23, it's a startling fact that you realize that most of these suicides are youth suicides. And when you look at the data further, you realize that most of them are actually male suicides. That's a really important thing to sort of identify as well.
But why the male?
That's a really tough question, and I think it's something that needs to be examined more. Okay. But we can, you know, look at certain basic facts, like more of our women go to university than our men do, right? Okay. So that's one, you know, it's a really tough question. You have this, you know, it's general where you have to be taking care of the family stuff. I can't really speak, you know, it hasn't been investigated enough, okay. but it's an important fact.
Like the male is the head of the household trying to. Okay. What resources do you have for Inuit youth to take part in?
So right now, like we're recipients of Trillium's Youth Opportunities Fund here in Toronto. Okay. So our youth group here in Toronto is so the Youth Opportunities Fund was part of a larger provincial framework called Stepping Up, Improving Youth Outcomes. And so in that legislation, what they identified were 15 different outcomes. Five of those outcomes make up the Youth Opportunities Fund. Mm-hmm. So any grant that goes through the Youth Opportunities Fund has to improve one of those five outcomes. And so we have two of them, and those two are youth are engaged in their communities and youth build and maintain healthy relationships. So through that grant, we were able to first secure space at the Center for Social Innovation, which is a cooperative workspace. And through there, we were able to have sort of a desk, full-time employee, which was myself, and then space for, you know, you can rent out boardrooms and stuff for different events. As time's gone on, we've been able to pool resources, and now we have a dedicated space for Inuit at the Native Canadian Center in Toronto.
Okay.
And so through that, we're able to, offer a number of programs, including sewing classes, including Tundra Squad events like Oyo Kayaking, community feasts, and just a place to come for the different drop-in hours for any community members who want to come and just, you know, hang out. What's really amazing is we're starting this library. So mm-hmm. we're getting a whole bunch of resources donated to us from places like Nunavut Arctic College, okay. From like the Inuvialuit region. So we're building a library there, and we're going to have a checkout system so we can kind of, you know, see, you know, what our community members are reading. Another cool thing is we just recently there's another body in Toronto called the Toronto Inuit Association. So I'm on the board of directors for that as well. We incorporated in September. So when we had our youth group started, this wasn't existed yet.
Okay.
But in September of last year, we incorporated as the Toronto Inuit Association. So through that, we actually have a languages initiative now. So we're going to be building a web application for beginner Inuktitut. It would be South Baffin dialect. There's different dialects as you go across the Arctic.
Okay.
So we'd be really highlighting that specific dialect right now. But through that, we can have a beginner web application that we would use then to apply for more funding to try and build a bigger application. And that's really going through our vision of trying to preserve traditional Inuit knowledge.
Okay. Now, you say your web application. Is it for, like, also, like, handheld devices and, like, laptops and things like that?
You'd be able to access it on that, but that's not our main focus at this point. We only have so much resources. By March 31st of next year, we have to have this application completed.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, we want to make more of a high-quality web app that looks impressive enough that we can give to funders to then start looking at having maybe a mobile app and stuff too, right? Like, we don't want to make it too big and then it's not good enough and then, you know, you go to apply for more funding and you don't get it. Like, we want to, you know, start low, aim low, make it nice, make it good, make it strong, and then go on from there.
Okay. Man, you're blowing my mind right now. Oh. It's awesome right now. Okay. How do you believe this helps in the mental health and mental health society and communities?
Do you mean Inuit specific or just in general?
Inuit specific.
So I myself, I grew up in Keswick, Ontario, just outside of Toronto. I grew up the white side of my family. I was the only Inuk that I knew for most of my entire life. Mm-hmm. And I felt alone for most of my entire life. And this is a very common experience for Inuit who live outside of the four regions. You end up being the only Inuk that you know anywhere you go. Mm-hmm. And it's so for a lot of us, my mom was part of something called the 60 Scoop.
Okay.
And so in the 1960s, the government of Canada authorized the Catholic Church to go into northern communities and forcibly remove children from their homes and bring them to adoptive families in the south. Actually, you guys have, I noticed out there, there's an advertising for Indigenous kids, and it was from the 60s Scoop. And so I was kind of like, I saw that just before I came in.
Okay.
You guys have something out there. So I wonder if there's ever like an ad there for my mom. That'd be a really interesting thing to know and find. But with that, you know, she grew up disconnected from the culture, and as a result, I grew up disconnected from the culture. And so there is this really interesting dichotomy when you're outside of it, where it's really hard for you to identify yourself as belonging to that community when you've never met anyone from that community, when you don't really know anything about it. But it's really hard for you to not identify as that, especially I grew up in a small white town. So once midsummer hit, you know, I was very, very well tanned. But people notice that. People notice that. And you get treated differently for being that way. And when people find out, you know, they don't say Inuit, they say Eskimo to you, right? And then they take popular culture references. Like, I remember there was this music video on Mad TV. It was called,
yeah, I remember Mad TV.
Yeah, it was called Gay Eskimo. And so kids used to sing that to me all the time. And so it's like,
oh my God.
You have like, you feel like there's like this attachment to your identity through popular culture. You see it as something to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
And because you don't have that connection, it's really difficult for you to, I guess, feel like you belong in places. And so to be able to start building these organizations here in the South so that, you know, other Inuit don't have to go through experiences that I've gone through, experiences that our other leaders in our community have gone through, experiences that just other Inuit living in the South have gone through. It's really important to mental health in that way. So really smoothing that path for self-identification and giving youth who would otherwise feel lonely and outside a place where they feel accepted and safe.
A lot of people, they laugh at things they don't understand, I feel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah. It's a very human thing.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. When it comes to issues of suicide, why do you think the Inuit population surfaces so much, and how do you think resources from the council can help them?
So I think I'm not sure if audience members could hear it, but before you played a song from Kelly Fraser. She's and a new musician. She was part of this documentary that was called Saul, and it was all about sort of suicide in the North. And one of the guys in that movie really said something amazing. And I think it's important for listeners to – so Inuit, we were colonized last, essentially. Like, we had contact with Europeans, but most of the devastating impacts didn't really happen until, you know, the mid-20th century when we were forced into our communities that we're in now. And actually, the RCMP had shot our dogs so we couldn't leave the communities. And so it hasn't been until we've been, you know, forced into these communities that you really see this suicide rate skyrocket, or when, you know, the 60s scoop happened and residential schools happened. You really haven't seen that spike. 100 years ago, we weren't killing ourselves. That's an important thing to remember. And so he had said something really important in this movie. He said, you know, we're not killing ourselves because of suicide. We're killing ourselves because of residential schools. We're killing ourselves because of forced relocation. We're killing ourselves. And he just started listing all of the things that have happened since contact with Europeans. And so the spike is really just in this change of lifestyle. And I've had the opportunity to go up north a few times. And you know, what I see there is this very big small town mentality. Mm-hmm. And it really resonated with me because I grew up in a small town. I know what they could do to you. Mm-hmm. And it's like this crab in the bucket thing, right? If you start to succeed, you get pulled down.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you're not given a lot of resources when you're in a small town. You know, right. There's no college or university in a small town. You leave the small town to go to those places. There's no real employment opportunities in a small town. And when you look at the North specifically, the biggest employer in the North is the government. And the majority of the employees in the North are not Inuit. And so when you look at the majority of jobs and who's actually having those jobs, it's not Inuit who have those jobs.
That's true.
And so when you are then not able to, you know, support yourself, support your families, to live a way that you want, when you don't have sovereignty over your life.
Right.
I think that would pressure anybody to you know, make that decision.
A lot of things that you just said, it's absolutely true, especially in the urban community as well. How can we take part in the council?
So a big one, you know, an opportunity like this.
How can a gentleman like me take part in the council?
Yeah. So a big part of it is, you know, giving us a space like this to share. To share our voice. And another one too is there are a lot of events. So if you guys follow our Facebook page, you'll see different opportunities that will come around. And I think just understanding that when you meet Inuit, we don't necessarily know all of this history. I didn't know all this history for a very long time, right? Mm-hmm. So meeting us where we're at, you know, treating us like we're humans, but then also, I guess, spreading that word. Be willing to have these conversations, not just, you know, I often have a lot of people come up and tell me about all the amazing work they've done in northern communities or all the amazing stuff they've done for Indigenous people. And that's fine. That's great. You know, I'm not here to pat you on the back, but I'm also not here to say that's not great work that you've done.
Yeah.
But go tell that to your friends at your cocktail party, right?
Exactly.
Those people that you might not otherwise, like, you know, tell that to them.
Yeah.
Because we already know that. We hear it. We live it every day. And so to be able to share our stories with people who haven't heard it, that's probably the most important thing you can do.
As president, what challenges have you faced in curating this council?
So a lot there's quite a few challenges in the beginning. We were the only grant for Inuit here, and so a big challenge was we were a youth specific grant for youth between 12 and 25. But because there's no other funding for the community, it was kind of expected of me to, you know, service the entire community. And with that, you know, there's a lot of expectations of you. People think that we have unlimited resources. We don't have unlimited resources. And so just being able to navigate and manage my own time effectively. That's probably a big, you know, not having the capacity to deliver the programs that we need to deliver.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Strabel.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. That's all the time we have on That's the Flavor. We just want to thank Mr. Strabel for joining us in studio at RadioRegion.com talking about the National Urban Inuit Council of Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening and another edition of Catch the Flavor. And please stay tuned after this show because you'll be listening to Murphy Brown right here at RadioRegion.com.
To be an urban Inuk is to endure conflicting ideas of being. There is a common need for both the urban citizen and the traditional Inuk. Both are fully dependent on the land which we occupy. Despite this shared dependency, this man often yearns for some missing element. So, where does such an individual find his identity? No practice of sustenance, sharing of stories, or way of being was left behind. While new stories were shared and experienced, the old ones reverberated gently as to never be forgotten. To connect with these experiences, the urban Inuk must return to the community where his family is from. The homecoming for the urban Inuk is the most important part of his experience and marks the discovery of his true identity. What he will bring home is a thirst for knowledge. This homecoming is a celebration with family, a celebration with the land, and a celebration of community. The homecoming is a turning point. The homecoming is where an Inuk man finds himself.
Atzurona kuli doaruma anana meri khaisuvani upatsuni pimarimi demelali ikaw niga tartumi nigubaro vani sanyani upatsuni pimarimi demelali demelali Demi lovely, demi lovely, demi lovely. Uchari bimarimi, demi lovely. Ino lima umatini sukusi mari nuna jali marmi. Chari mari kiro labdui, demi lovely. Tamani ngitui inui. Dakula miui, giu yon lap tui, demi lovely, demi lovely, demi lovely, demi lovely, demi lovely, uhai pimarimi, demi lovely, demi lovely, demi lovely, demi lovely, demi lovely. Hari bimarimi demi lovely. Natuni anana meri khaisuvani ukhatsuni bimarimi demelali 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 kyuru halaptu demelali 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 Demi lovely,
Make